Lynn Alden, founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategy. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
It's great to speak with you again, Lynn. Of course, it's always a little bit of a mind stretch for me to wrap my head around your content and especially the conversation that we have, but I was really looking forward to this. And of course, you and I have talked about a lot about fiscal dominance before and how that affects the ability of the US to continue to service its debt. But of course, with the last, week or two here of the Iran war, and especially what that has done to oil prices, I'd like to understand more from your perspective, entering a war that uses very expensive weapon stores and systems that need to be rebuilt, as well as a spiking oil price, how that affects the picture on the path forward that the Fed was kind of easing into, as you termed it, the gradual print here.
Yeah, so if we zoom out for a second, one of the challenges is that fiscal dominance, or more broadly, sovereign debt crises tend to lead to war, unfortunately. And then also in the reverse, war tends to contribute to periods of sovereign debt crisis and fiscal dominance. So it's not really an accident that you kind of have clusters of crises that tend to emerge. Obviously, the precise timing can differ, but we are certainly living in quote-unquote interesting times, for the most part, unfortunately. And so that does kind of complicate the whole investment landscape. And, when I laid out the gradual print, I still think that's on point on like that. That's still my base case, by the way, to get to the short of it. So basically going, when we look at the kind of expectations before this whole kinetic action broke out, my view was, there's people calling for like a huge printing in kind of the near term. There are many people that think that the Fed's going to reduce its balance sheet in the kind of near intermediate term, including potentially the incoming Fed chair. And my view was that the most likely outcome is that we would see a gradual print, that we would end this period of quantitative tightening, transition to a period of a flattish balance sheet, and then likely a gradually rising balance sheet that's roughly in line with nominal GDP growth or with bank deposit growth. And that has ramifications, but that it's neither of those extremes. And then in my February piece, I outlined there are some scenarios that can pull forward the risk of a much bigger print, and war was one of them. And then there are scenarios that you can actually reduce the balance sheet a little bit further. They tend to be liquidity neutral, though. They pull out liquidity from elsewhere, so they're not quite kind of the hawkish action that one might expect. We could, if you want to go into the financial plumbing, we can. But my base case, at least at the current time, with this level of war, is that the gradual print is still the base case. When we look at, how much the war costs on a daily or weekly basis, while, what's a few billion between friends, but it's a big number, and obviously in any absolute sense, but in relation to the size of the U.S. economy, even in relation to the current interest expense, this isn't like a game changer in terms of the math. Obviously, it can be nonlinear. This can spiral significantly. So I would say it has certainly added variance and uncertainty to the gradual print scenario, because we've pulled forward the risk, and we're actually at war, but we pulled forward a risk of even potentially bigger war. It's very, at this time, as we're having this conversation, we want this to be, not just over in a week, like not outdated in a week. I mean, we don't know how long this war is going to last. We don't know how much damage is going to happen that could make it harder for energy to get back online in intermediate term. So there's a lot of questions still in the air. If you'd like, we can go and kind of pick apart some of those nuances. But I would say overall, it hasn't changed what I expect around the Fed's balance sheet growth. Mm-hmm. But it does obviously have macro implications. I mean, this is a key reason why I have energy stocks in my portfolio, because they tend to be uncorrelated with other things, because an energy crisis can be good for some companies, but can be disastrous for most equities, as well as bonds and currencies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to tease apart and really try to understand this, but you mentioned that, what's a couple billion dollars between friends at this point, that seems to be, let's say the war ends close to now. Of course, we're recording this on the about noon on March 11th. But does if we see a continued spike in energy prices, is that really one of the more detrimental pieces of this puzzle that could throw a wrench into the gradual print?
Not in a intermediate term sense. I don't think that the Fed would greatly change their balance sheet strategy in, say, a 3 month or 6 month period, based on what happens with energy, other than potentially some extreme worst case scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when we look at, you know, what would make the Fed want to print, the stock market going down 5%, 10%, 15, 20% even, is not really one of those scenarios. The main scenarios would be disruptions in the interbank lending market, and that, you know, that's a key reason why they ended their balance sheet reduction and have transitioned to a balance sheet expansion. They were getting early signs of disruption. They already had standing facilities in place to handle those disruptions when they happened, which is why they didn't really cause an actual crisis. They were just kind of flare-ups. They put out the fire by expanding their balance sheet. They're still under the surface, some liquidity shortages there, but that's why they're ongoing balance sheet expansion. The other main thing would be a dysfunction in the treasury market. There's no kind of realistic scenario where they would let the treasury market become illiquid or otherwise broken for any kind of meaningful period of time. That's kind of one of those, they have an emergency meeting and to handle it, you know, within the day type of situation. And they also, again, have standing facilities to help with that when needed. So they have these kind of, and they also have, you know, swap lines that are standing with a number of countries should there be an international liquidity issue, which then if those get tapped, they can then have meetings and, you know, potentially take temporary actions to expand them. So we'll that's kind of the early signs to watch. None of this in the near term, based on current information, threatens those things that would make them want to just dramatically change their balance sheet strategy. Mm-hmm. Now, if this expands and just China says we want to sell all of our treasuries, you know, next month, that's the type of thing that, yeah, the Fed could say, well, it broke the treasury market. Mm-hmm. So we have to buy more than we thought because now we're in outright financial war, essentially. Mm-hmm. Or if Japan has an energy crisis that gets bad enough where they say, hey, US, we're your ally, but we got like a trillion treasuries and we got, you know, energies, let's say energies, you know, oil's 200 a barrel, this kind of a terrible scenario. They say, look, you know, in order to avoid a fiscal crisis, we got to liquidate 200 billion in treasuries. Mm-hmm. If the market can't disrupt that, like absorb that properly, we could see the Fed say, hey, we were going to expand the balance sheet by this much, but because of such and such, we have to double that. Right. That still wouldn't be there's not that many scenarios that give you like $1 trillion in rapid printing other than like the most extreme ones. But there are scenarios that could, you know, make the gradual print a little bit steeper. Mm-hmm. And then it's somewhere between a gradual print and a bigger print. Those are the kind of the options I would start looking at before I would consider some of these more extreme options.
Right. So, Lynn, when we lay out this, you know, the reaction so far by the markets, has the treasury market, you know, shown any signs of stress or lack of liquidity, which is, you know, the important part of what you mentioned?
We have seen the volatility index go up. So we've seen the move index get elevated. We've not, you know, other than a little bit before the war broke out, we actually saw like one particular or two particular days of a little bit of stress. Mm-hmm. Nothing unusual. Really, ever since the year end, we've not really seen disruptions. The reason that the end of a quarter and especially the end of a year tend to be messy is a lot of financial institutions do what they call window dressing, because that's like their snapshot for what it's going to look like when they report on the quarter. Right. So there are a lot of firms that scramble for liquidity at the same time. And then there are other firms that have too much liquidity and it looks like they haven't deployed their liquidity. So they actually want to have less liquidity in that moment for that little snapshot. So you have like a lot of moving parts at the same time. And it's a scenario where the Fed's more likely to you know, get their standing facilities tapped to some degree. Mm-hmm. So we saw some minor issues at the end of the quarter. That was also when the Fed was transitioning to their balance sheet expansion. It's been pretty quiet including during this war since then, which is elevated, you know, across the board. You know, when you have oil trading like a meme coin, when you have, you know, stocks down, stocks up. I mean, stocks have been pretty muted as well overall, but there has been some flare-ups. I would say there's early signs of minor stress, but nothing particularly alarming.
Well, it seems to be that this is, you know, all about liquidity, both in the stock market and the treasury market and the interbank lending market. So to go back to how you laid this out, do these market disruptions and this war expenditure add, you know, stress and liquidity needs, especially coming into April, into tax season, as you highlighted in that piece as well?
Well, so the Fed has, at least, you know, before the war, they have anticipated that tax season would be a liquidity drain, and the mechanism for that, it's kind of, this is plumbing details, but basically, ironically, when the Treasury fills up their cash account, that's bad for liquidity because that's coming out of the banking system. You can kind of think of three buckets that together are pretty conserved. There's, you know, the bank reserves. Then there's you know, reverse repo accounts and things like that, and then there's like the Treasury General Account. And when the Treasury General Account fills up, it comes out of those other pockets. And the reverse repo facility is already practically empty, so it's basically right now the two effective buckets are bank reserves and the Treasury General Account. If you get a bunch of tax receipts at the same time, you can fill up the Treasury General Account by, you know, tens or potentially hundreds of billions of dollars above kind of expectations, and that comes out of the banking system. So the Fed has specifically said, back at this was back in like December, that from now through tax season, we're going to do somewhat elevated QE. They didn't call it QE, but they're going to do somewhat elevated balance sheet expansion. And then you know, the rough numbers going around, they're you know, the Fed is not a you know, there's a full board, so they can have different opinions. So that the board had an opinion, and the chairman had his own opinion. But the, you know, the chairman's numbers were something like, okay, we think we need to expand at a baseline of 20 to 25 billion a month, but we're going to do something like 40 billion in the next few months per month to kind of get ahead of the potential, you know, tax issues in April. And the overall board had slightly no lower numbers. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out. All of those scenarios are within the gradual print c confines. Even if you were to do 60 billion a month, that's still a gradual print scenario. So those are all well within the margin. And so it's quite possible that this could elevate it. And they stay on the higher end, maybe a little longer, or they go a little above their expectations. That's not even my base case yet, but that's a very reasonable outcome that could happen. It's still within the gradual print scenario.
Right, it's just kind of on that upper bound, let's say. So, Lynn, why is the Fed so focused on the short end of the curve in order to grow the balance sheet? Is this kind of a continuation of Yellen's financing debt on the short end of the curve during Biden's presidency?
Well, in some ways, it's the opposite. It's well, there's a couple of moving parts there. The Treasury, ironically, so Scott Bessent, he's doing roughly what Yellen was doing that he criticized Yellen for, which is financing more of the government debt on the shorter end, because that puts less pressure on the financial system. It's putting less duration into the system. The closer you get to, you know, like the shortest T-bills there are, the more money like they are. It's more like you're just directly printing money if you're just printing a bunch of T-bills to finance yourself. The challenge is then they roll over very quickly, and it's kind of a mess. You can't really lock in your interest rates. And so the government has been operating much like the Yellen Treasury was. The Fed is trying to somewhat do the opposite because they don't want this to look like QE. They don't want to call it QE. And so they've limited their net duration purchases to, I believe it was 3 years or less, which is T-bills and some of the shorter T-notes. It's still some duration, ironically, but it's on the shorter end. And the reason for that is like in the Fed's kind of ideal state, like if they just say a clean sheet of paper, what should our balance sheet look like? It should primarily look like shorter duration treasuries. That serve as their asset side so that it matches their bank reserves that are their liabilities, and then they're kind of market neutral. The other scenario is that they, you know, if their treasury portfolio looks roughly weighted like the overall debt outstanding of the Treasury would, then that would also kind of meet that sort of neutral guideline. What they don't want is to have a ton of duration on their balance sheet, because then it looks like they're doing soft yield curve control. And they also don't, ideally, they don't want mortgage-backed securities, because it shows that they're interfering with the housing market. They have their finger on the scale there. So their long-term plans are to keep reducing their mortgage-backed securities, while shifting over the very long term, many, many years, toward a all treasury portfolio, and ideally not excess duration. Now we'll see how much they manage to keep that plan. When we go further, when we look at years ahead, I mean, that's where a gradual print could turn back into a bigger print. But yeah, that's essentially what they're doing with that shorter duration, is that they're actually trying to be a little bit on the hawkish side by saying, we're not going to finance all that duration. But the dovish part is actually on the Treasury's part, where they're still issuing more shorter duration stuff than would be normal.
So, Lynn, obviously, Kevin Warsh is being pointed at as the new Fed chair, and he still needs to be confirmed. But how does this outlook change with the, let's say, the personalities within the White House and or the Fed? I've had discussions around the idea that Trump is trying to kind of stack the Fed with people that are sympathetic to his cause and the way that he wants to do things. So looking out further, as we were just talking about, how do the personalities within the Fed end up changing the strategy that is currently being embarked upon?
The short answer is slowly, because at any given time there are 12 members of the FOMC. Seven of them are Fed Board of Governors, and then five of them are rotating regional bank heads. With the New York one always being on, that's the one that doesn't rotate. The other four rotate. So at any given time, it's not a one person vote. It's a group vote. Obviously, the chairman has disproportional ability to kind of influence the group and to control the Fed's microphone to a significant degree. So switching over the Fed chair is like the biggest individual piece you can do, but it's still just one piece. You can have dissenting votes. We have recently had some dissenting votes on what to do with policy. The ironic thing with the proposed new Fed chair is that he's historically on the hawkish side, whereas presumably, because of what President Trump has been criticizing, is he wants a more dovish Fed. Many market participants have kind of been on record saying that this looks like Scott Bessent's kind of selection, that maybe it's not the person Trump would have picked on his own, but it's the one that Trump's been told this is like a credible pick that won't look like you're just stacking the Fed. It looks, he's been on the Fed before. He's very likely going to pass nomination. So I think that's the moving part here. If you look at his actual comments, the proposed new Fed chair's comments, he's been recently pretty dovish on interest rates. So we probably can expect that he'd be in favor of cutting interest rates. Now, if he can, he'd have to, again, convince the rest of the voting bloc to do that, but he'd have some weight to do that. So all else being equal, probably give us a slightly more dovish path on interest rates. He does seem quite resistant to expanding the balance sheet. He's even talked about shrinking the balance sheet, which I alluded to before. And the some of the mechanisms he has available to do that, like he could, for example, and he can't, again, he can't do this unilaterally, but he can push to have certain bank deregulations occur, which actually the Fed has already done around the margins, but they could go further in. That allows banks to kind of hold more treasuries without affecting their various like leverage ratios that they have to hold to. That's a very similar to QE, because it just lets the banks kind of do QE on the Fed's behalf, because that's it's fractional reserve lending. There's kind of two types of balance sheets that can hold treasuries. There's ones that are like relatively unlevered, so that's like just private investor funds or insurance companies and things like these really big pools of capital, or just individuals, or the foreign sector. These big pools of capital that can buy treasuries, but that means they're not buying something else. And then there's entities that can do it on printed money. They can do it on fractional reserve. They're not necessarily displacing something else. They're just levering themselves up more. So that would include commercial banks, and it includes central banks. And so his kind of proposition is to have a little bit more of that in commercial banks and elsewhere, which is kind of liquidity neutral. We also talked before about how Scott Bessent has not been terming out the debt the way he kind of proposed he would. If he were to do that, there'd be cost to doing it because he'd have more treasury duration in the system. But the one advantage he would get is that he could run with a slightly lower treasury general cash account. The reason, part of the reason it has to be so big is because they always have so many T-bills coming due any given month, and they have to have that kind of cash buffer to handle that churn. So if they say, okay, well, we're going to have half as many T-bills outstanding, we're going to term all this out, it would put pressure on the long end of the curve, all else being equal, but it would let them have a slightly lower TGA, which then lets the Fed have a slightly smaller balance sheet because that TGA goes back into the banking system. This we're getting kind of deep into the weeds on financial plumbing here. But the point is, there are some kind of liquidity neutral moves they can do that let the Fed have a slightly smaller balance sheet and just kind of use other pockets of liquidity to do that. I think they'll be quite limited on that because, again, most of those are not unilateral decisions. So I just think he'll be somewhat resilient to not expanding the balance sheet quicker than he has to. It's not like, stocks went down 5%. Better, turn up the printers. But again, the main thing that almost regardless of who's running the Fed or who is the president at the time, they're not going to let the interbank lending market be illiquid or broken for any stretch of time, and they're not going to let the treasury market be illiquid or broken for any stretch of time. A combination of standing facilities and outright balance sheet expansion. That those are they'll kind of resort to those in any number that's needed to make sure those two things don't stay disrupted.
Right, because that ends up being one of the biggest, let's say, risk factors for things really breaking, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it just comes to a halt if those things are not working. You I mean, basically, entities are having to force sell other assets at that point, and you get like a recursive issue. It just kind of the market freezes. Kind of like an example is at the very bottom of the COVID sell-off back in March 2020. Things just outright broke. And obviously, that was a very all this new information was hitting the market at the same time, almost all bad information. So you have a lot of forced selling, deleveraging, so many forced sellers, and no one's stepping in to buy it. So you just have the treasury market itself just has huge bid-ask spreads. It's supposed to be the most liquid, deepest market in the world, but it's like effectively frozen. Until the Fed says, you know what, we're going to be the clearing, we're going to come in with $1 trillion of liquidity in a number of weeks and just make that market clear again. Now you could get, again, in either kinetic war or financial war, you could have a repeat of that. But just more broadly, if you get a number of factors all together, if you have a mild or moderate or severe energy crisis, mixed with stocks not doing great, partially because of that. If that is severe or prolonged enough, then those things can then hit back at the treasury market because the US is so financialized that if our stocks are flat to down for a year, it starts to then with like a lag impact our tax receipts, which then widen to the deficit. And if you're already kind of, if you already filled up the insurance companies and you banks are pretty full on treasuries, and if foreigners are not buying because they're dealing with their own energy crisis, and if anything, they might be selling treasuries, or at least around the margins, then it could be that the Fed has to step in and kind of do a higher purchase than they expected. With again, many scenarios are still on the upper end of the gradual print range, and it's not even clear we're going to touch the upper bound yet. But those are kind of scenarios to consider.
So Lynn, when we're th thinking about the all important tax receipts here, is there a risk to, an oil price spike preceding a recession and or a housing market collapse? I was reading the other day that many of the past oil price spikes would or have preceded a housing market crash, but is there, let's say, to understand that a little bit better, is there a particular duration that that spike has to last for in order to have that effect on the housing market in your mind?
Well, so that would depend on the other conditions at the time. I think in the current context, it would require a rather prolonged energy price spike to severely affect housing, because as we've already seen, let's back up for a second. The way that energy can affect housing is a few ways. One, if that contributes to overall price inflation, it can make the long end of the bond curve sell off, so you can have higher interest rates, which then can affect mortgage rates. So all else being equal, you know, it's just less affordable for houses to change hands. That's one. Two, if the overall just economy outside of the energy sector is doing poorly, partially because of energy shortages, maybe other factors like AI and, you know, whatever the case may be, we're talking about energy crises. You know, people aren't very confident about the future. They're saying, well, let's hold off on the home purchase for the next couple months, which means sellers are kind of stuck. And then, you know, they potentially could have to sell at a lower price than they otherwise would have. Now, I would point out that the housing market's been rather resilient for years now. I mean, it was resilient to the 2022 energy crisis. And even since then, just the you know, from 2022 to the present, we've had, you know, higher than expected interest rates from what people thought in 2021. And the housing market has, you know, if you look at like the Case-Shiller U.S. You know, national index, it's been like flattish. If anything, it's been flattish to up. Obviously, some markets that were particularly bubbly, especially where they can build a ton of new supply, those have come down. Other ones that are more linear markets, they've been flat to upish, because you have kind of not a lot of people buying houses, but not a lot of people selling houses. Mm-hmm. You have a decent number of houses that are just held without a mortgage. Houses kind of shifted over time, unfortunately, to the higher, like the upper decile of owners in terms of wealth and income. Those are the ones that can just kind of buy and either not leverage it, or they can just, you know, if they wanted to sell, but then they can't get the price they wanted. So they say, well, we'll just wait then, you know, we can just wait. So these things, higher energy price can result in a lower housing market, but because of the size of the fiscal deficits, because of the level of bid from those wealthier buyers, it's kind of a levitating force. So my view for a while has been that we'll see a flattish housing market. That has been the case, and I expect that in most snares, I think that will continue to be the case. Again, anything if something gets truly extreme enough, then yes, it can you know, cause issues. I do think that before we would get to a true kind of U.S. housing meltdown, we probably would get to a bigger print scenario, right? So we would start to see cracks where the gradual print would the base case would then transition more to a bigger print, which would then be probably offsetting at least some of that housing price malaise. So you can have a situation where housing prices go flat, but that's an inflationary environment. So, you know, it's like nominally they're doing okay. In real terms, it's not great. These are all kind of, I think, reasonable expectations for what could happen if an energy price issue maintains long term.
Then, of course, you know, much of what we've been talking about is the need for liquidity. I was reading that you think that, or correct me if I'm wrong here, but Bitcoin is kind of a proxy for global liquidity. Why is that, and how is it behaving in that way?
So from analysis we did, you know, something like a year ago, we found that among all assets, Bitcoin has a closer correlation to liquidity than other assets. Now, in general, risk on assets like equities generally have a positive correlation with liquidity, that when liquidity is good, risk on assets are usually doing pretty good. When liquidity is poor, usually other things aren't great. People selling their risk assets, they're going to risk off assets. Mm-hmm. In extreme environments, even risk off assets can do poorly. Like in the bottom of COVID sell off, even though it was the most risk off scenario you can have, it got liquidity got so bad that people were just forced selling bonds and gold because they had to. So if it gets bad enough, even risk off assets can have that issue. But in general, the riskier assets, the little bit more kind of positive correlation has. Bitcoin is interesting because unlike equities, it doesn't have earnings. It doesn't really have quote unquote fundamentals. I mean, it has its own fundamentals like network effects and security and just the way it's built. But those fundamentals don't really change on a quarterly basis. You don't get new information like you do with a company. And so it doesn't really have that extra noise that could say, okay, well, liquidity is not great, but this company is killing it on earnings, so it's able to rise despite poor liquidity. Bitcoin is a little bit more of just a pure play on liquidity. Gold would be the same because it's a scarce asset that doesn't have earnings, but because it's this large established asset, it's got a little bit more of that risk off aspect to it, which complicates its liquidity correlation. So just almost by process of elimination, being a risk on rather volatile asset that does not have earnings, it just happens to correlate with liquidity better than any other asset we tracked. Something like 83% of the time in a given 12-month period, it moves in the direction of liquidity. The other 17%, it doesn't, and usually that's associated with valuation, meaning that when it has, Bitcoin's had these kind of periodic bubbles. When it hits those very euphoric levels, when it just, it just 5x'd or something, then in the next 12 months, regardless of what liquidity does, Bitcoin usually has a sell-off just because it's got so much, it's already gone to the moon, so it's got a lot of downward pressure. And lately, in the past, call it 6 months, even 12 months, it's been one of those exception periods where liquidity's been decent, not amazing, but liquidity's been decent, maybe until recently, and yet Bitcoin sold off, so it had its own idiosyncratic factors. We had obviously very strong precious metals move. We also had those treasury companies that were kind of, I mean, that's where the euphoria was. All this kind of Bitcoin companies that held Bitcoin and were trading it like 8 times their NAV, and so it was one of the situations where Bitcoin was over its skis, and therefore it was kind of temporarily deflating, even as liquidity was pretty decent around it.
So you mentioned this idea that everything gets sold off when liquidity gets tight. You said you mentioned forced selling of bonds and even gold in the bottom of the COVID sell-off. Do you think that that's part of what happened to gold and silver here and their reaction to or their price reaction to the beginning of the war?
I think that's part of it, which is that when uncertainty breaks out, or when someone is just degrossing, they're deleveraging a portfolio, they might sell their winners, they might sell what's liquid, but the complicating factor there is, much like how I just mentioned, when Bitcoin has one of its local bubbles, it just runs out of steam and can deflate for no particular reason. Liquidity could still be fine, but it just, just the forces that pumped it up that far are just kind of rolling over. The euphoria that gold and especially silver reached in this local sense can mean that they can just sell off just because they don't have a reason to keep going up in the near term. That the liquidity could be decent, and just markets just spooked by it, and then you get kind of momentum on the. Kind of like how you know momentum. People bought just because it's going up, and algorithms just buying because it's going up. You get people and algorithms selling just because it's going down, until you get more, buyers that say, "Well, this is actually the price I want to own," and you kind of set that new floor. So I think it can have a. I mean, if anything, it's healthy for them not to just go up all the time, because then you clear the market, you test the price a little bit, you snap out of that kind of recursive buying, and you kind of make sure that the market's still healthy.
Yeah, it seems like those markets kind of got to a point where they were overbought, and that complicates that pure signal of just forced selling because everybody needed basically cash, right?
Basically, any extremely overvalued market or euphoric market, because they're not always the same thing. You can have something that's temporarily euphoric. It's not overvalued. Like if you start undervalued and you quickly go to fairly valued, you can be locally euphoric even though you're not overvalued. You can have often you'll have both incur together. Let's say the dot-com bubble, you've got ex very expensive stocks combined with euphoria. The problem there is that regardless of what liquidity does for the next few years, there's just so much air that has to come out of that bubble. So you can have just stocks gradually going sideways down, almost regardless of what liquidity is doing, just because that market is so big that some printing doesn't really matter. And I think the way I would describe it is that gold, silver, and to some extent platinum got euphoric but not overvalued, which is that they quickly moved from fairly cheap to like pretty reasonably priced, I would say. But just the sheer speed of that move, the sheer number of mentions on social media, the kind of the retail interest kicking in. To some degree, that was kind of a local euphoria period, which means the correlation could just break down just because that level of euphoria is unsustainable.
So to get a better sense of this valuation of the precious metals right now, I was reading in your report there that when we measure gold specifically against US stocks, we're in the fourth bear market for stocks in the modern era. So is that one of the factors that kind of brings us to this understanding, let's say, of a fairer valuation for gold?
That's one of the factors. So one of them is ratios. So you can look at gold to other commodities, gold to oil, for example. The caveat being that being the hardest commodity, meaning the one with the highest stock to flow ratio, the one that whose supply is able to kind of go up the slowest compared to other commodities, you should expect it to over time kind of reach higher highs compared to other commodities. Like gold, in extreme sense, gold should over the long arc of time be able to buy you more wheat rather than just be flat versus wheat. And then the harder you get, oil's harder to get than wheat, and silver's harder to get than oil. So you should see kind of gold probably making higher highs over the very long arc of time. But when you do get kind of in extremes, it does at least pay to be a little bit cautious around, is this now overbought? But then you want to go outside of commodities and say, I think more broadly, what percentage of portfolios are in gold? Compared to historical norms, or compared to what they theoretically could be. And that's where it's more of an art than a science. There's no firm number that says, okay, this is where gold is reasonably valued, this is where gold is overvalued, undervalued. It's more of like, there's a range of scenarios that make sense. People can have different opinions about what the scenarios are. That's why there's a market. And so my view for a while is that, gold, silver, and platinum were all kind of on the lower end of what makes sense. Gold was doing a little bit better than the others, so it was, maybe not the very bottom, but silver and platinum were roughly at the bottom of what makes sense. Gold was kind of closer to the bottom than the top. After this kind of price surge, it has obviously got euphoric in the kind of technical sense. Gold got ex and to some extent silver also got expensive relative to other commodities, which was a little bit concerning. But the part where they were still relatively not that overvalued on was percentage of global assets. And that's where there's a discussion of, should gold have a lower percentage than it used to? If you say, okay, well, 50 years ago or 100 years ago, there's just fewer things to own. We had less of an information economy. Maybe it made sense for gold to be 15 or 20%. Maybe now it makes sense for gold to be 2%. That'd be kind of the bear scenario. We're saying that gold is not kept up, but that's makes sense. The bull would say, okay, well, maybe over that time it made sense, but now that we're entering a period of fiscal dominance, sovereign debt crises, the world is saying maybe we don't want to just almost only own treasuries anymore. When you look and say, okay, well, what can I own in stocks? Costco is trading at 50 times earnings. And you're like, is it going to go to 60 times earnings, or could it fall to 30 even, which is still not cheap, but could it fall to 30? That's where the case for like precious metals makes sense. And then you can bring Bitcoin into discussion and say, well, to what extent are they going to share that kind of self-custodial store of value liquid, money type asset? Obviously, a gold bull and a which that doesn't like Bitcoin would say, well, Bitcoin over the next 5, 10 years is probably going to diminish, and so it's not going to be a big competitor. A really big Bitcoin bull might say that it's going to keep demonetizing gold. It's going to keep, it's going to become a multi-tens trillion dollar asset. It's going to eat into the growth that gold could otherwise have in that market. Someone like me is somewhere in the middle. I'm bullish on both assets. I don't think Bitcoin is going to demonetize gold, but I do think it's going to likely continue to appreciate. So I like to own both assets. But I generally still think that the overall kind of bearer asset money, store of value assets are not overvalued in terms of portfolio allocations, either at the sovereign level, the individual level, the hedge fund level. I think they got over their skis for a while there, but I don't think they're overvalued.
Do you think that, in this transition to, let's say, away from the West and including more of the East, with central banks, especially in the East, buying a lot more gold, does gold become a more, more integral part of the financial system? And, can we include Bitcoin in that discussion as well?
So my base case is that we are entering a more multipolar world. I had an initial article on this back in 2020. I had a section of my book, Broken Money, on it. I do think that neutral reserve assets are going to become a much bigger piece of the global financial system. And recently, because of the price appreciation, gold has. you know, the percentage of sovereign reserves in gold increased a little bit because of extra buying, but mostly just from price appreciation. And so, you know, if you hold two assets and one doubles and the other one doesn't, you know, this the ratio changes. And I think through a combination of new purchases and selling, as well as price appreciation, I do think that neutral reserve assets are going to become a larger share going forward. That's part of why I don't think, you know, precious metals are overvalued. Gold's obviously the incumbent choice there. It's the only other asset that's kind of big and liquid enough to be comparable to the U.S. Treasury market, you know, in the tens of trillions of dollars market cap range. And, you know, obviously with a very long history, and it's already widely held by sovereigns. Bitcoin is like the you know, the newer one. It's 17 years old. The advantage it has is that it also serves as a settlement network. We've seen many years of all these countries trying to make these little agreements to like build their own closed source like settlement networks that, you know, can operate outside of SWIFT and all this and outside of the correspondent banking system. And you always see these headlines, and then years later, you're like, you know, not a lot of volume came out of that. And obviously, you know, since 2022, things have kind of accelerated a little bit, but still, it's a very dollar-centric world in terms of settlement. The advantage Bitcoin has is it's a settlement network. It's an open-source functional settlement network that does settle trillions a year. That's still small compared to total settlement volumes. I mean, the Fed does over $1 quadrillion a year in settlement, which sounds like a fake number. It's a thousand. It's a thousand trillions. In the past few years, that's how much they do per year, and that's not even the whole world of settlement. That's just, you know, that's the biggest one. And also, obviously, China does huge numbers. And so it is this combined store value and permissionless payment and settlement between, you know, potentially sovereigns. The main issue now is it's, you know, it's a little bit over $1 trillion market cap. It's volatile. There's career risk. You know, if someone at a central bank says, let's buy Bitcoin, and then it goes down 50%, that person's career prospects are probably not great. On the other hand, if they pose in a bear market, they might be right, but their boss probably isn't going to listen to them. So people tend to buy Bitcoin in a bull market. So I do think that Bitcoin has a potential role to play in sovereign entities. The main issue is it has to be bigger and less volatile before it would truly interest them. So I think it catches on at the corporate level before we see a lot of kind of sovereign level interest. And it would have to kind of clear that hurdle before we have those conversations more seriously.
Lynn, does reducing margin requirements on gold and silver versus raising them on oil let gold be more of a release valve for the current energy squeeze? And this is an idea that Luke Roman recently pointed out. You know, in theory, it could be looked at as that, but you know, is there more to understand there, do you think?
I mean, I think he's right on that, and I would defer to him on a lot of the details and the nuances there. He follows news items in that those that particular dynamic more closely than I do, because it's been a core part of his thesis, which he's been right on. I mean, especially until recently, the gold to oil ratio, he called for it to be much higher and has gone much higher. Obviously, the whole energy crisis throws a little bit of a curve all that, but it still structurally makes sense. And I do think that over time there is a kind of a I do think that China and more broadly kind of non-Western aligned, you know, entities are looking to get more interested in neutral reserves, neutral reserve assets, with gold being the primary incumbent. And so I do think that all these mechanisms, you know, trading that's outside of London, outside of New York, as well as various levers they can pull, are part of why we see kind of gold reintroducing itself in sovereign reserves and kind of being that offset.
Lynn, one of the other, you know, big parts of the market that, you know, makes headlines when there's not a war going on is the Japanese yield market or the Japanese debt markets. You know, they've been rising, yields have been rising to, in some cases, 25-year highs. Do you think that this is a as big of a threat to the global markets and especially the US equity markets as many pointed out to be?
So I'm in the camp that it's not as big of an item as it has been made out to be, but that's not to say that it's not a big item. It's up there. It's one of the things I'm watching, but it's not like this gigantic thing, in my opinion. It's large. Basically, you know, Japan is you know one of the biggest creditor nations in the world. They ran decades of trade and current account surpluses. They invested assets globally. And in addition, other entities come in and say, well, you know, because your interest rates are so low, because you're further into fiscal dominance than any other country, you know, we're going to borrow yen and then we're going to go and buy other assets with it that are not Japanese. And so anytime the yen gets way stronger or the interest rate on borrowing gets much higher, you could see some of those entities having to deleverage and therefore sell some assets to you know offset their yen liabilities. In addition, you can see actions in Japan that say, hey, you know, we you know we're taking all these actions that are kind of devaluing our currency, which might make borrowers want to keep borrowing it, but you know we might want to say, okay, well, we're going to provide headwinds on households or entities in Japan from investing abroad. You know, we're going to have some of that capital come back, either by raising interest rates and therefore enticing it, or in some cases by mandating it, saying, you know, hey, your pension, you can only have this percentage globally, so, and you're over that limit, so you have 3 months to comply and bring assets home, for example. All those things around the margins, given the size of you know the whole carry trade as well as just Japanese assets, is a non-trivial variable for assets globally. Now it's again we're talking in a world of hundreds of trillions of dollars of financial assets, so equities, bonds, private equity, real estate, precious metals. You know this is you know it's a one big variable in a very large sea. So something I'm watching. It's a factor, but also I think especially before this energy crisis, I think that Japan has a very long runway ahead. I don't think we're going to see a nonlinear blow-up of Japan anytime soon. They're further ahead on fiscal dominance than any other country, but they have, again, they're a creditor nation. They have a lot of foreign assets that they can gradually sell off. They don't have to do it at once. They can gradually sell that off to kind of offset their demographic shift. And two, they're a very harmonious society. So they can handle higher levels of things that are tight without ripping themselves apart in the way that the rest of us seem prone to do. Now one of their Achilles heels is energy because you know they don't have a lot of domestic energy. They obviously they do what they can with nuclear and coal and things like that, but you know a lot of their oil and gas has to come from abroad. And so higher energy is a problem. Now in a poorer country, energy price spikes can be absolutely disastrous. Japan, even though they need energy. The what they have going for them is that they're quite wealthy, so they are able to you know if oil doubles, it's not great, but they can absorb that. And so my threshold for what starts to become a nonlinear like disaster in Japan and therefore spreading to the rest of the world is probably higher and longer energy price issues than what I think the base case would be.
And that would kind of necessitate them selling some of those reserves, which, as you pointed out earlier, I think they hold something like over $1 trillion in US treasuries,
Yeah,
right?
they do, and then you know more broadly they have trillions in other assets, you know not all at the sovereign level obviously spread across their pensions and households and things like that, but yeah the kind of the earlier step is that they have those treasuries, but we're in a world you know where tens of billions goes a long way when it comes to dealing with energy crises, or you know in severe cases hundreds of billions. And so when we're talking, we were talking before about, you know, the Fed debating, is it 25 billion a month in balance sheet increases or 40 billion? And that ironically is all considered gradual print. You know, it doesn't really get into the higher echelon until you start hitting like well over 100 billion a month. Japan would have to do quite a lot of selling in a quite condensed period of time to impact the types of numbers that are already on the table as the baseline.
Excellent, Lynn. Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything that you think that investors should keep an eye on or consider as we, continue through this interesting time here?
I mean, I think we covered a lot of it. I think that the main thing is we are even before this particular thing, we're in a period of just elevated shocks and headlines because we're in a fourth turning, we're in a slow motion sovereign debt crisis across multiple countries. We're in a rising power, stagnant power scenario. We're in a world that's very unipolar, especially at the kind of the fall of the Soviet Union. We hit kind of peak unipolar world, and we've been, especially in the past, decade or so, in this more multipolar world, which that's the more historically normal situation for thousands of years, is a somewhat multipolar world. And I do think we're slowly moving back, at least partially in that direction, and that comes with this shocks all the time. So I think that we're going to have many crises, like for the foreseeable future, like for any sort of investable time horizon, call it 5+ years, we're going to keep having many crises. True crises like total war, or you can't really plan for either personal life or investing wise. So kind of extreme outliers you put aside, a lot of kind of what we have set up is already expected. It's just, what order did they happen, and what time frame did they happen? This year? Did they happen next year? Did they happen 2 years from now? Which happens first? So there are a lot of variables like that, but it all comes down to being somewhat diversified, owning assets that are not overowned, therefore that they're not overvalued structurally, so that they might have volatility shocks, but they're unlikely to just completely collapse in price and stay down indefinitely because they weren't overvalued to begin with. And embedding some assumption of chaos into your models, and what assets are better to own when chaos is structurally higher than it was in the, call it, the 90s, the kind of the peak, like low chaos era. I think that's what we have to think of going forward. And then in the background, as a baseline, you have that gradual print scenario. And if ch bigger crises break out, you get a bigger print scenario, which then is this offsetting factor nominally, which, basically it just keeps implying you want to own scarce, high quality assets that are not overowned. So even good assets can get temporarily overowned. Avoid euphoria, avoid things that are overowned, and otherwise own high quality, scarce stuff, and some degree of diversification to avoid tail risks.
Well said, Lynn. I really appreciate that answer of, as intricate as it is, it's something very important to consider. Of course, your newsletters and excellent articles are all available at lynnalden.com, and of course on X at Lynn Alden Contact. Anywhere else you want to share, like your Noster?
Yeah, people can check out primal.net/Lynn for decentralized social media. I have a new sci-fi book coming out that people might want to check out. You can check out my Twitter or my homepage, and you'll see more information on that in the coming days. But yeah, we live
Excellent.
in fun times.
Absolutely. Good luck with the sci-fi book, Lynn.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time today.